ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Alan Kohler, and I want to take you straight to the source. Every Friday, I sit down with the people running companies, shaping industries, and influencing the Australian economy to talk risk, power, profit, pressure, not just their success, but their strategy and what it means for the rest of us. Because that's business. Search, subscribe, and stay ahead. Find That's Business with Alan Kohler on the ABC Business Daily feed, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcast.
After close to a decade of negotiations, Australia and the European Union have signed a landmark free trade agreement. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has hailed it as a defining moment for the relationship, while the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen labelled it a win on both sides. And a new joint security and defence agreement has also been inked, aimed at strengthening cooperation between Australia and Europe amid pressing global challenges. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelis.
And I'm Raf Epstein from ABC Radio Melbourne.
And Raf, the free trade agreement between Australia and the EU is finally going to happen. This is actually a big deal because it's been nearly, it's like the baby's been close to being given birth, but then up, there's a disruption and then it goes back into a long, long, long pregnancy. So the details, shut up. I'm giving it a go. It is. It's been like the baby's nearly come a few times. It doesn't come. The details. Well, the details. A lot of reaction to which we'll get to. Some basically saying it's a crappy deal for Australia. All right, let's get through this part first. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen is addressing the Parliament as we're recording. Few just fun facts. You know, she is the first female foreign leader ever to address the lower house like this. So this is, you know, quite significant. She hailed a new era of economic and security partnership between Australia and the European Union, which it certainly is. It is extremely interesting. But why has it happened? I mean, Raf, there's only one reason it's happened. It's really clear because it wasn't that dissimilar. There have been some changes, to be fair. But, you know, it was on the same track, but it was put off in the past. Well, there's one change. It's called Donald Trump, and he's smashing the world order. And free trade has been very important to Australia and the EU, and there's this push to really try and turbocharge it with other jurisdictions when the US is acting the way it is. That's basically the backstory, isn't it?
I think that's 100% the backstory. The EU is literally running around the world making trade deals. The EU's made deals with Indonesia and India recently. This trip by the EU president was put off until they could iron out all these details. The PM even said as much. Like, the quotes in his press conference today, they won't be in the headlines, but he actually said free trade is under pressure at the moment, which is his way, of course, of saying, oh my God, there's this 100-pound gorilla called Donald Trump. And he said it is possible to stick to the rules. So there's no doubt if you're Australia or the European Union, you're trying to find a way around it. Just before we get stuck into the cheaper cheese and cheaper electric cars, it is a bit like you get a car and you get a car. Like, it is literally everybody gets a car, and Ursula von der Leyen saying everybody's a winner. It's worth thinking about how important America is versus how important Europe is. Europe's economy has only grown a bit in the last two decades. It's grown by, like, I think it's 13%. America's economy in the last two decades has nearly doubled. So as important as all these trade deals are, there's a reason everybody treads so carefully around America. It's not just their military might and their ability to apply tariffs. Their economy might be really crappy for the average American, but it's just growing so fast. It's grown much faster than Europe's economy. So yes, these deals are important. And yes, everyone wants to find their way around Trump, but we need access to America's economy just because it's the biggest economy in the world. Should we go through why it's so important that our farmers can still call their stuff Parmesan and Prosecco?
Yeah, let's go to that, because that's like, okay, so for us, a few sticking points. We're going to get to the beef stuff in a moment and the kind of reaction. Farmers not happy, and I'll get to that in a moment. But yes, on these labels. So the Feta, the Prosecco, these are the labels which are very linked to particular countries. You know, Greek Feta, for instance, that these countries, which of course are part of the EU, have been fighting pretty hard, haven't they, to say you cannot use our language as you trade. But that's changed, sort of.
Well, it has changed. They get to keep it here. They have to phase it out. I think the Prosecco one, so within 10 years, Australians making anything that you could call Prosecco can't call it Prosecco overseas, but they can call it that here. It's interesting, like to go back to the Trump point, Trump's stomping on everyone's trade. Therefore, we'll come to a compromise on things like Prosecco. Do you have feta with Prosecco or Parmesan with Prosecco? What's your preference? I'm trying to work out. Probably Parmesan with Prosecco probably goes better. But the main thing is we all get to call it that and our farmers get to use it that way. And we get cheaper cars, PK. I noticed that one of the taxes on the electric cars, that's gone from, instead of a tax being imposed at 80 grand, it'll get imposed at 120 grand. Mm-hmm. So that should make electric cars cheaper. And the 5% tax that'll make cheese cheaper. So if you can afford one of those really expensive, stinky, soft French cheeses, it'll get, by the way, it only gets cheaper, it takes 2 or 3 years to get cheaper, but that'll also make some luxury cars cheaper. So it's, I think that's important politically for the government. They can say you'll be able to buy a whole lot of consumer goods more cheaply. It's really important to know as well that almost any advanced manufacturing that happens in Australia, you're going to buy some sort of sophisticated machine for your factory from a country like Italy. That's sort of still their specialty. So all those things that actually speak to whether or not we've got our own supply chain, if we can make our own stuff, this trade pact helps with that. Also helps with things like access to academic research in Europe. But PK, like, I'm just looking at my notes on the details. Does it have a political impact? Do voters who aren't listening to the podcast even notice the trade pact's being signed?
Yeah, no, this is one of those things where do consumers and voters go, oh, that free trade agreement with the EU's been signed.
Gosh, Albo's good.
Yeah. Yeah, we've radically changed. No, they don't. However, I think, you know, people obviously consume news in headlines and bite sizes, and the story is we've done another deal that helps our economy and people want stability. That was the message from Ursula von der Leyen.
Yeah, very much.
People are very much looking for stability, and this is a demonstration that we are seeking as much as we can economic growth and stability by doing this deal. That's what I think the sort of marker is. I think it's interesting, though, we talked about the Prosecco and the Feta, but farmers are already really angry, right? So government has essentially done a deal which the NFF is pretty unhappy with, and that's the National Farmers Federation. And that makes them very close and happy friends with the Nationals, for instance. I think already we've got Matt Canavan, the new Nationals leader. He's slammed it as basically a terrible deal for farmers. Now, Labor obviously wanted a deal, but the compromise that they've made to export 30,000 tonnes of beef to Europe, you know, isn't that dissimilar to what a claim was in 2023, I think?
When it didn't get over the line.
No, because it wasn't good enough. Australia said that wasn't good enough. So now it's good enough. So again, what's changed Australia? Well, Australia would say, yeah, we've got a bit of a deal on labelling, on Prosecco and other things. So, of course, there's lots of things on a list, and that's the point of a negotiation. You give and you take, you give and you take. But I do think that's going to be a bit of a political headache for the government. Not a huge one, but a bit of one. I say not a huge one because I'm going to speak in raw politics. You correct me if I'm wrong, but Labor doesn't really represent a lot of farmers, so I don't think they'll be sort of crying about their seats. But impressions matter, and if they look like they've sold out farmers and the coalition is able to mount that argument, that's not helpful for them, right?
No, I don't think it's helpful. I mean, just a few facts first. Like, I didn't know any of this stuff. We don't really sell much beef to Europe. We sell hundreds of thousands of tons of beef to the United States. So we're going off a low floor from something like 3,000 tons to 35,000 tons a year. So that's a tenfold increase. That's a lot. It's also important because they sell the best stuff to Europe. They sell the highest grade cattle. So it's something the government can say. Like, if we get into the politics now, the government can say our farmers can now sell a lot more beef to Europe, they can make a lot more money selling beef to Europe. But the NFF say they're extremely disappointed that no deal would have been better than a bad deal like this. Matt Canavan, you mentioned, his words are the government's rolled over. I do think that feeds into the general conversation. Like you and you were focusing yesterday on, you know, One Nation. We all know One Nation is now part of the conversation, one of the three major parties, as some of us have been quipping. This feeds into that narrative. If you've got the same farmers, like they are literally ringing into my show saying they can't afford to farm. Like I literally had someone from the Macedon Rangers today saying, why am I bothering to make wine and pick fruit if I can't afford the diesel that I'm using day by day? So it does feed into that. It's another thing that the government has to struggle with. But I think free trade deals in a normal political environment, it's a bit of this and a bit of that. You know, it's on you give with this and you get with that. So I don't know that it presents anything significant. I do think, though, and maybe this is where we go to next, it's part of that broader conversation of how you deal with the world as it is. They were talking defence today, and I thought they really dead-batted any questions about the war, didn't they?
They certainly did. You know, I think it's interesting the way that there is a sort of real reluctance, isn't there, to stray into that territory. There's a carefulness. I know you noted it when the Prime Minister was talking about Ukraine and that ongoing war and the different language he uses, right?
He's happy to say free trade's under pressure. He's happy to say it's possible to stick to the rules. He voluntarily mentioned, no one mentioned Ukraine. He called the Ukraine war an illegal war. He did not make that judgment on the war that the Americans and the Israelis have started against Iran. He pointedly did not call that an illegal war. But just keep in mind the backdrop to the questions that the EU president and the prime minister faced. Trump's called NATO cowards for not helping on the Straits of Hormuz, and he said that he's very surprised that Australia hasn't helped. So that's the stuff that Trump's flung out there. When I say dead battered, the EU commissioner basically was asked, or has he started a war he can't stop? Oh, it'd be nice if there were negotiations, and I'm sure that he can't actually, America can't expect any help in the Straits of Hormuz until after the hostilities have ended, which is the exact opposite of what Trump wants. And Albo's answer was also really interesting. You know, he was asked about, well, you know, we get oil from there. Don't we need to help there? And he's like, oh, we sent a spy plane to the United Arab Emirates. It's on the northern part of the Strait of Hormuz. We've done our bit. So they're just completely, they are making deals in the face of Trump and because of Trump. But when it comes now to his direct demands, the things he says about Australia and Europe on social media, they sort of just stick their heads, their fingers in their ears and close their eyes and say, well, it's just a toddler tantrum. We're not going to address it anymore. And I think that's, maybe that is the direction of travel now. They're signing up, like I mentioned, to hopefully it means that Australia gets more access to research dollars for our universities and the research done by our high-tech companies. And maybe they're just sort of hoping the storm and the Trump problems go away. Is that their approach?
Hoping and praying. I mean, I woke up to news this morning. You wake up earlier because you do a morning show, but like these days I'm having nicer mornings. I woke up to the news that he'd had a taco moment, you know. Yeah. Trump always chickens out, right? Like, isn't that what's happened again? Trump's given another 5 days to Iran before he, you know, kind of makes good on his threat to blow up their facilities if they don't, you know, open up the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, this is just the stuff of fiction. It changes all the time. It's made up. So the government is hoping lots of things. It just hopes that it goes away, but it knows nothing really, as far as I can see, about whether it will. Do you believe that they're getting any information which is high quality and, you know, no, there's that they are literally making many contingencies, hoping for the best, but knowing that whatever happens, the economic ramifications are with us. So let's give you some evidence. We have now rate rises and the war pushing consumer confidence into what like is
COVID territory.
It's the lowest, yeah? I think it's the lowest on record. So already we are seeing the consequences of this war in our economy, right? So that's the government's focus, I think, now. How to manage that as they construct this budget, managing sort of the optics of requests on the war effort, as a sort of footnote, but wanting the focus to be on how they manage the economic ramifications. That's I think, the first, second and third thing they're concerned about. The fuel crisis, which I suspect will continue to be a big issue in question time again today, is the only show in town. We have many petrol stations that have run out of fuel. That's the government says it's not a supply issue, it's about distribution.
But it's about people buying too much.
Yeah. Okay, let's accept that, although we already know there have been some cancellations of ships that were coming through Asia and then to us. But if you are going to one of those petrol stations and it says no more petrol here, what do you reckon's happening? Raph, what do you reckon your view is on that? I mean, we are in the crisis. In New Zealand, they are constructing a kind of bailout to help people who are lower income as a result of the war and the crisis on the economy. Are we going to be getting into that territory soon? I mean, around the world, there are COVID-like measures starting from, you know, please work from home. Business has pushed back against that and Chris Bowen's suggestion that people should think about it. Government is very, very careful because it's learned the lessons of the COVID pandemic that if you push too hard, you're going to get smacked in the nose. But equally, if there's not enough fuel and it's not being distributed fast enough, if we accept the line that it's there but just not in the right places, how do we manage things? Like, how do we actually manage anything?
How do we manage anything? Let me give you two examples of things politicians have said to me on the radio. And you and I, PK, we know when we speak to people at the top of government, they are worried about Trump. They think about Trump. They're nervous about Trump. They don't know what to do about Trump. One thing the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, said to me on the radio last week, he goes through Trump's transcripts line by line. So this is a guy who's going into meetings every day, drafting the budget. As he said on Politics Now yesterday, they are literally doing budget meetings every day. While he's doing that, he's going through Trump's transcripts line by line, trying to work out what that means. And then I had our state Victorian Energy Minister on the radio today. 10% of the petrol stations in Victoria at 8 a.m. this morning didn't have petrol or diesel. Now, that's a rough figure. There's 101 stations that had no petrol. There are 83 stations that had no diesel. There's some overlay there, but it's roughly 10% of the petrol stations. So think about that. If you're a state government minister, you've never confronted an energy problem like this. 10% of your stations up, you know, around that don't have fuel. You're the treasurer trying to frame a budget, and you don't know what the war's going to look like next week. That's really difficult territory, and you've got to try to speak to and address voters who don't know if their 3-ton trailer is going to cost them double to drag around behind the ute next week. Like, they are genuinely, genuinely difficult problems. And I think actually politicians are responding less to Trump publicly and contemplating even more what he might do next. And I think that's a deliciously difficult challenge for our federal politicians. What do you reckon?
I just love that you called it deliciously difficult, you alliteration nut job.
Well, there is a deliciousness to it. Only it's horrible, obviously, but we've never been this sophisticated. We've never had an economy this complex. We haven't had government involvement in an economy like this for quite some time, if you consider the complexity of education and the scale of the NDIS. Yeah. So that's tough.
I've got to say at the moment, I'm like just going to put it out there. I'm getting massive 70s vibes at the moment. I've got like this, the oil shock. Anyone who kind of, I'm a bit young for it, but I've got older siblings and stuff. But I remember like the 70s were full of kind of rolling teacher strikes in Victoria, of course, today. Teachers who have walked off the job and are striking for a pay deal in Victoria where you, of course, broadcast. You know, there's the ABC action that's coming up as well. Like, are you getting 70s vibes?
Yeah, I just hope it doesn't become 30s vibes, but 100%.
Yeah. No, it's true.
But of course, it's that sort of it does feel like the tectonic plates are shifting. Keep in mind as well, like, I'm only just old enough to have lived through fuel rationing. I don't remember it in Victoria, the odds and evens number plate thing that my listeners mention every single day. Many of them remember it. But keep this in mind, like, in the mid-70s, when Iran was friendly to America, the Shah was on American TV saying, you don't like the oil squeeze that's a result of the war in the Middle East? I don't care. 50 years later, we have not shifted. Sure, there's been some shift towards renewables. We are still heavily reliant. Our entire economy is 30 days away from falling to pieces because we are reliant on fossil fuels. Hasn't shifted in 50 years. So 100% 70s vibes. And all those strikes are 100%, they're not induced by this war, but the war's going to make all of those claims for more pay. And they're just the first off the, they're the first cab off the rank, aren't they, the Victorian teachers?
Mm.
Inflation, by the way, you've been talking about for a few years. It's here to stay. So, yeah, definitely 1970s vibes. The question is, how do they respond, right? And that's what you've also been talking about on the pod and we've been talking about on the radio. How brave are they going to be? How big are they going to go in May?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, 70s vibes, my searing analysis. I know that's why they come here for this pod. It's doing well. Thank you for listening and telling your friends.
You just need 70s music, okay? If you're really going to go 70s vibes, you need 70s music.
I am very, very in favour of that, can I say. A bit of Donna Summer for me. Okay, so let me ask you this. It's been 1,000 days since the Murphy Gambling Review was handed down. It found that gambling losses and harm were driven by aggressive advertising and recommended a phased ban on online gambling ads. This government, not particularly interested, it seems. Is this what happens? Is this what you get for a 94-seat majority? Picking and choosing.
Back in 1970, in the 70s, I think you had to drive up to the Murray to play a poker machine, and there was certainly no online gambling to continue the 70s theme. I tell you, if there's one thing that unites my listeners, they do not understand why there is not an advertising ban on gambling. My audience is very heavily AFL focused. I wish they all listened to it on ABC Radio, but they do, in fact, a lot of them watch it on TV. We all see those gambling ads. We had a chat today to the researcher who's worried about women being targeted for gambling, especially young women. Like they know, the advertisers know, and the gambling companies know, and you will know if you've got any young men in your life. Young men are really very, very likely to be gambling while they're drinking. They've got a casino in their pocket. It's called the smartphone. The gambling companies are now targeting young women because they're like, untapped potential. They're not just asking them to bet on the AFL. They're not just asking them to bet on a Matilda's goal. You could bet on what people wore at the Oscars, this sort of novelty gambling. You can bet on sort of things that are happening on Married at First Sight. They are using things like that. They're using people called what do they call them? Finfluencers, the financial influencers. They are using people like that to try to suck young women or more of them into gambling. It's perfectly legal, of course, but we know that almost all people who gamble with this sort of stuff lose their money. And I just get this universal, not almost universal response of people on my radio station saying, why haven't they banned the gambling advertising? And in fact, the researcher from one of the universities in Melbourne said today, she thinks it's as simple as the AFL's addicted to gambling. The free-to-air TVs are addicted to gambling. They tell the federal government they need the gambling ads, and that's why the federal government hasn't removed it, despite however many seat majority they've got.
And don't forget, the Prime Minister went into the last election without having done anything on it. He got rewarded with a landslide victory. When that happens, I think that politicians sometimes take the wrong messages, in my view, which is that, you know, these things the media gets obsessed with. They're the sort of language they use, by the way, behind our backs or even in front of us if they're in the mood. But really, you know, that's not a core issue. Look, that might be the case. I mean, but I think these things mount up, Raph. I really do. I think cumulatively over a period of time, these things start to sting, and I think they better watch out for that. I don't think it's meaningless. I don't think it's going to swing an entire election, something like this, but I don't think it's meaningless.
It's not meaningless. I think I'm trying to divide up in my mind now, what are the issues that might cost a government or an opposition politically? So that's one set of issues, and maybe this falls into that. And then what are the issues that actually erode people's trust in the system itself? If there's one message to take out of One Nation's rise, I think you can make a strong argument. Pauline Hanson's for a very long time, played the race card and used prejudice. I think it's also the case that those 1 in 5 voters across the country thinking about One Nation, they're thinking about One Nation because they're losing faith in the system itself. And here's the big difference to the 1970s, right? If you were a Whitlam supporter, you were furious with the Governor General for bending the rules, but you had faith in the rules. You had faith in the system. And even if inflation was terrible, the argument was, how can you use the system to address those problems. The thing that I find disturbing about the debate in the middle of the 2020s is some of these issues fall into the territory, and I think the petrol supply issue falls here, when I have listeners not believing the government when they say that the ships are still coming. These issues fall into the territory of the system sucks, the system is lying to me, the system has not delivered for me, the system has given me shocks like the GFC, COVID, and now the fuel problems we have. I want to get rid of the system. And I think it's those issues, those sentiments that really fuel One Nation. And then it doesn't matter what Angus Taylor says about migration. It doesn't matter what Anthony Albanese says about free trade. People have stopped listening and they're turning to the people who, just like Donald Trump, want to throw all of the cards up in the air.
Beautifully said, Raf. That's why I love you co-hosting with me.
I said it with a heavy heart. Yeah. Said it with a heavy heart.
All of it is really heavy at the moment, right?
No. But 70s vibe, next time, let's get the mirror ball going.
Yeah, I know. Can we get the good bits of the 70s too? Not just the sort of rolling chaos? Yes.
Here's my challenge to you, Patricia Karvelas. Yeah. If you agree to do this podcast while on roller skates, I will too. Okay? That's the challenge.
You know how all the cool kids could go on roller skates or on roller blades, which is more my era of the 90s? Me? Nah.
You don't skate?
Mate, I can't manage standing sometimes. Right, okay.
You're like Jerry Seinfeld. I choose not to run. Patricia Karvelas, I choose not to skate.
Yeah, okay. I do run though. It's the only thing I do. And it does massive damage to me. And right now I've got this weird pain in my sort of back leg.
You need a pod, a jogging pod, discussing running injuries.
I'm sure people would really want to listen to my random musings about my very average running. Raf, excellent to have you. Please send questions to theparty@abc.net.au and Fran and I will answer them. We'll be back. See you, Raf.
See you later.